You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
This is a Hat Trick
podcast.
Oh, lovely.
I'm Janet Ellis, and this is Twice Upon a Time, where each week I invite a guest to come and chat with me about their favourite childhood book. They often bring along their own battered copy. This is a podcast to celebrate that magical book which cast a spell over us and often still has us in its thrall. Welcome to Twice Upon a Time, and I'm so thrilled today that my guest is none other than presenter and broadcaster, although, to be perfectly honest, I think there are quite a few things missing from that description, and they're all good, Lorraine. Lorraine Kelly, thank you so much for giving up your time to this, Lorraine. I hope you had a nice time with your book again. What did you choose? Tell us about it.
I did. Well, I chose probably quite an interesting one. Claudine at St. Clair's. And this was actually not the first St. Clair's book, but it was the first one I got because I used to love the local library where I lived in the East End of Glasgow. It was my re-escape. And Claudine at St. Clair's was the first one. But it's not that, like I said, it's not the first one of the series. But then I went back and read them all.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I had to. I got so engrossed in the story.
Did you ever own a copy of them? Or were they all library books?
They were all library books until probably, I think, when I was about 11. That was when I started getting books as presents. I used to ask for books as presents because I was such a bookworm. I was always reading. I still am. I've still always got a book in my bag. It's one of the great joys in life. Best thing my mum and dad ever did for me was before I went to primary school, they taught me to read and write. So I was only probably about 4 and a half. You know, I mean, I wasn't reading War and Peace or anything, but I was still able to read and write. And it was a huge advantage. The best, like I say, the best present they could ever have given me. It was wonderful.
Have you read War and Peace since?
Oh, absolutely. I did. I did Russian at school. I didn't read it in the original Russian. That would be far too up my bottom. But I did read it when I was a kid and then reread it again. And yeah, it was brilliant. Brilliant book.
And where did you go? Did you have a place where you would squirrel your book away or did you just read wherever you were? Did you
have a special place? Well, it was strange. I mean, looking back on it, I actually read a lot at the library. I would go to the library just for some quiet because when I was a very, very little girl, we would just all stay in the one room in the Gorbals. And then we moved to Bridgeton in the East End of Glasgow. And there was only one bedroom and the living room. And I never really thought about that. It's only now that I think back, like we were all in the same bedroom. You know, me and my brother and my mum, my poor mum and dad. Poor mum and dad. But yeah, there wasn't really anywhere to go that was quiet. So I ended up going to the library to read. And that was my haven. I absolutely loved it. I loved it. I just felt very safe. And the librarian was fantastic. He was always recommending things to. She recommended me the Just William books as well and all of that. So it was great.
We'll touch on the whole notion of Enid Blyton, good or bad, later.
Yeah.
But was there any disapproval when you were reading her books?
Not then. Not then. And we weren't aware of it. I mean, when you read it now and you read it now, not so much the St. Clair's books, to be fair. There are some things in there that sort of make you wince a bit. But for me, the St. Clair's thing, when I came across it, was total escapism. First of all, I was a bit bemused. I thought it was like a punishment that girls were sent to school away from their mum and dad. I just thought that was like really weird. And so with my own experience, I couldn't understand it. Obviously, there were the great things like midnight feasts, you know, with the sardine paste, which I had no idea what that was. And ginger beer, I did have a rough idea what that was. But it was just such an alien world to me. And I think that was what was so captivating. And also, you can recognise, you know, that, I mean, you can see that they're all stereotypes, these, you know, the French girl that doesn't like going to play and she doesn't like games and she cheats and, you know, she's a little bit sort of not quite the thing. And what it screams at, you know, is class. It just, doesn't it? I mean, it's astonishing.
The big themes in this.
Oh, enormous.
Class, money, and
yes,
looks.
Absolutely. But to be fair to Enid Blyton, and we know all of the problems, but to be fair to her, while the girls, the girls that are there are sort of like, you know, upper class, or I don't know if you, yeah, I would say they're probably upper class, they're quite kind. You know, they are quite kind. And what they say is there's a code. You know, she talks a lot about the code. But they're not horrible to the girls that are, heaven forfend, that are working class. She's not, you know, our characters aren't particularly horrible to them, apart from the one who nobody likes anyway, who's a snob. They're a bit patronising towards the working class girls, but they're not evil. They're not horrible. And I think what I took away from it as a kid was that we're all the same. You know, it doesn't really matter how much money you've got. It doesn't really matter how pretty you are and, you know, what your clothes are like, what your parents are like almost, although that does come into it a lot. It's more about, and I like that. I like that sense of it's what you are as a person. So it sort of gets there in the end, but you have to wade through quite a lot of snobbery in the meantime.
Well, it's interesting that we're straight into talking about the characters in the book, because I like to say to people with their favourite book, you know, can you describe the plot? And I think I'd be putting you on the spot with this one. It's a bit, plot isn't really the word, is it? There
no,
are events,
there's
but
events.
There's not really a strong through line.
No, there's not. It's a series of events. You're absolutely right. It's, you know, two new pupils come in, which is always difficult for anybody being the new girl, whether it's coming into a school or a workplace or whatever. So that I found quite interesting. Always myself, always feeling a little bit of an outsider, so I quite identified, not so much with the French girl, but I did identify with the new characters, and it's just how they sort of find their way in the school. You know, Claudine is there because her aunt is the French teacher, Mamselle, who doesn't get a name, she's just Mamselle. Who talks in a very odd way, and they're all sort of slightly patting on the head, you know, she's like the figure of fun.
What she does brilliantly on the first page almost, is send you right into that classroom with those girls and in a few deft strokes tells you who they are to each other and what might happen next. And it's the most impressive scene setting, even
it
before
is.
The new girls arrive.
It absolutely, you're right there in that class, and I think that's what grabbed me, and because, like I say, it was such an alien world that I didn't understand. And yet, just by reading the first couple of pages, you're there. But even as a kid, I did recognise that there were things that were off, you know, the snobbishness and the classism and all the rest of it, and characters that were so stereotypical. Now, I know it's a book aimed at young people, but really, you know, really, like Angela, the beautiful princess, who's one of the new girls who comes in, and she's got the worst mother in the world, who's a terrible old snob and absolutely ghastly. And she was just a little bit too much. I mean, kids aren't really like that. But the one thing kids are like is there's the queen bee of the class. And she initially is that until all the girls discover that she's just, you know, a hollow snob. But the little girl that becomes Alison, that becomes her acolyte, really, her slave. And you saw that. I mean, we had that at school. Everybody wanted to be Kim Cranston's friend. They did. And she wasn't anything like Angela. She was a lovely girl. But there was just something about her that everybody wanted to be her pal. And we all sort of fought one another to sit beside her and hold her hand.
You're obviously somebody absolutely fascinated by that notion and spending time that, you know, is your own and precious. And yet, Lorraine, you didn't go to university to indulge
no,
this.
No, I didn't. And I didn't. I mean, I would have loved to. I was supposed to. I was supposed to go and do English and Russian. And then I got a job in the local newspaper. And I did have to. I mean, I always wanted to be a journalist. That was my thing that I wanted to do. And it was brilliant to have you know, the opportunity to do that, you know, to get that job as a wee cub reporter in the East Kilbride News. What a great start that was. Mum and Dad were a bit disappointed because I would have been the first one in the family to go to university, and they would have got, you know, the photograph in working class houses, the picture with the funny hat and the scroll. Oh, that. But luckily my baby brother, who's a genius, he went, so it was fine. It was all right in the end. But yeah, but I kind of am like, I think an awful lot of working class people back then, self-taught, read everything. And then my job, you know, Janet, every day you're learning something. One of the joys of my job is I get to read people's books that they've written. I mean, sometimes some are better than others, but it's a great thing to do, or to go and see the movie before it's out, or go and see their play, or whatever it may be. And that's a joy. You know, I love that. I learn something new absolutely every single day. And I'm probably, some might say nosy, but I would say curious. That's what I would say.
I would say curious. And going back to the book very enjoyably, I was instantly struck by the names too, because my own name is a real solid old-fashioned name. You are not going to look in a pram now and have somebody say, yes, this is little Janet. And the whole book is peppered with those names which have so gone out of fashion. We've raided the Victorian and Edwardian servants' quarters, but we haven't quite got to the 40s and 50s names yet.
No, we haven't. Like Roberta. I don't think there's many Robertas around like right now. That was interesting. And then Angela, because they call her the angel, you know, that was very, you know, that was a bit much, wasn't it? And Claudine, of course, had to be
and Pauline,
the
girl. And Eileen.
Pauline. Yeah,
and there is a Janet. And disconcertingly, their form teacher is Miss Ellis.
This
so
is
the names
true.
Janet and Miss Ellis appear on the same page.
Do you think maybe I was that was the message that I was getting? It probably was.
Miss Ellis is quite nice. She's good. Now, I tell you what shocked me more than halfway through this book is that these girls are 16.
Do you know? Yes.
One of them says, you know, my brother is 2 years older than me. He's 18. And I almost gasped aloud.
Me too.
The style and the writing and the preoccupations and the attitudes of these girls is, I don't know, conservatively 13, I would say.
Absolutely. I mean, they're not sophisticated in any way whatsoever. Reading it again, reading it now, reading it back, that really shocked me too. I couldn't believe. I was like, because you know what 16-year-old kids are like now. For goodness sake, my mum had me when she was 17. So, you know, this is really weird. But again, as a kid, I didn't really clock that. I didn't really notice that so much as I did now, you know, looking back. But you're absolutely right. It makes no sense.
In the cover of the book we have, you know, the girls front and centre, Claudine has a rather stylish, moodish bob.
She does. She looks like Louise Brooks.
And behind her, some girls who look very kind of hip. And then slightly to her left is a lad, long-haired, almost it's like denim, possibly leatherish jacket.
He looks like a bad lot.
He does, but the boys in the book are so much ciphers. I mean, there's a brother, and he's literally a shadowy figure for all sorts of reasons.
He's just
he
a
has
brother.
To keep out of sight.
Yeah.
There's the boy who delivers the fish, who they all look down on.
And obviously, because he's a horny-handed working class boy.
Yes, exactly. And then there's Angela, you know, Angela, the gorgeous blonde. Her father, who towards the end of the book is a good and solid, if absent, presence.
Mm.
But there's no other blokes at all. And I don't know about you at 16, Rain, but that's kind of all I was mainly thinking about.
Well, I was a very slow developer, which is probably why I quite liked the St. Clair's and Mallory Towers thing. But you're right. You're absolutely right. There was nothing. It was all about sort of like having passions on one another. You know, it was more about the relationships with the girls, not in any way sexual at all. You know, there's nothing like that they were saying, certainly. Although Roberta, or Bobby, as she was called, she was a wee bit like the Famous Five one. You know, that's quite interesting. But there wasn't anything like that. But yeah, there was just, men were kind of, they weren't really there. And you're right about the dad in the end. The dad wanted Angela to go to the school because he wanted the corners knocked off her. I mean, I've never heard of that phrase for 100 years. That was the thing about some of the phrases. I mean, I barely laughed at some of them. They're absolutely ridiculous.
I wrote so many down. Well, to go back to Bobby,
yes.
Very early on in the book, I mean, page 6, Bobby is described as very like a boy in her ways, full of fun and tricks, and not being at all lovely herself, always admired beauty in others. That's page 7,
yes,
and that
is
a recurring theme, how the plain look up to the beautiful all the time.
Yes. I mean, they call Angela, pale golden hair, bobbed like angels in pictures, and a pointed face like a pixie, and a voice like a princess. And you can imagine the voice like a princess would not be the way I speak. The voice like a princess would be absolutely upper class, crystal. You know, sometimes people of that class to me always sound as if they're shouting into a gale. And it all feel like this. So, yeah, that's her idea. I guess that's seen as Blighton's idea of perfection.
That's because they're at opposite ends of the hunting field or whatever.
That would be at opposite ends of the very, very big table. Darling, pass the salt.
And Angela, this proved to be terrible, but, you know, absolutely gorgeous to look at girl. Even her school uniform has been tailored.
It has.
So that it looks, it's the same as everybody else's, but it looks beautiful.
But, yes, because she's had it all made to measure and fitted. And I love the way that she carries around three tennis rackets. Not one tennis racket, not two, but three, whether she needs them or not.
And let me offer you up for your edification, Carlotta.
Carlotta
is the
exotic
circus
Carlotta girl
who amused the others by turning cartwheels or going completely mad in a foreign Spanish way.
I mean, I'm laughing, but that really is desperate.
They had a little go a while back to kind of bring these up to the modern time. And, you know, they swapped saying, you know, bathing for swimming and that kind of thing. And actually, like you, when I read these books, I mean, I was actually Mallory Towers more than St. Clair's. But I cannot remember reading them with any sense of judgment at all, except the judgments that the girls themselves are encouraged to make, which are to do with honour and fairness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they talk about slapping each other quite a lot, which I think will probably be edited out in an updated version. But but they're not, as you say, they're not mean to each other.
No, they're not bad girls.
Unless the meanness is a sort of blatant meanness, but it has a purpose, you know, stealing money because you need something, as Eileen does, or, you know, hiding because you need to go and visit your brother who's unfortunately lost his job and needs money. But but so much of Enid Blyton, I think, must come. And given that she wrote at one point 50 books a year.
How does she do it?
Like automatic writing, isn't it?
Yeah, some of it.
And I think... Yeah. In a way, that's why it's so delicious, because she's not stopping to edit herself, you know. And I don't know about you, but when I'm writing, I go back over things.
Absolutely.
Go at that. But I don't think she did. Mm. And also it meant that she could add in little things that occurred to her at the time, whether or not they were relevant. I mean, there's a brilliant bit with Claudine, the French girl, who, when it comes up to half term, which is a huge event.
Oh, big deal, big, huge event. Huge deal. Yeah.
And I noticed actually lasts a day. Often, when they're all picked up by their parents, the parents watch, you know, poor things, they're all playing tennis or whatever, and then they take them out for an obligatory meal and then deliver them back. But Claudine, being French, her family are in France, she can't therefore reunite with her family. But Enid Blyton says she'd, because she was one of a large family, she'd only got a small share of the parents' love and attention and had not missed them much at all.
Yes.
You know, then she moves on, of course. That's not plot, that's nothing. It's just something that Enid Blyton, I think, was thinking at the time.
Yeah, and just put it in, and it doesn't advance anything. It doesn't do anything. And that's just rather, and it's rather sad. You know, and the thing is about these sweeping generalisations that she makes. I mean, you mentioned Carlotta, who I wanted to be Carlotta. I thought she was fantastic. She could do things like, I've never been able to do a cartwheel in my life. I don't know where I'd be in the hospital if I did a cartwheel. But I just thought
so would several other people if I didn't.
I thought she was brilliant. I don't know what you were supposed to think of her, but I find the adjectives round about her quite disturbing. You wouldn't get away with that now. Not really. Not especially like later when you actually read her story. You know, in one of the previous books, that does sound alarm bells quite loudly.
Well, people have actually died in her family.
I know,
to make it possible for her to attend the school.
Indeed.
So,
yes.
Yes. But again, it's interesting, isn't it, that none of this jeopardy actually makes anyone deeply unhappy. Enid Blyton can mention as an aside that somebody has lost a parent, but you are then swept up into the fact that they're all going to have stink balls in the classroom.
Oh, see, that was a strange one, wasn't it? When I was reading that, I just didn't get that. I thought to myself, we would have got absolutely killed if we'd done that in school.
Also, they were in little glass canisters that you were required to break with your thumb. Mm-hmm. I thought, hazard? That's a bit of a hazard.
It was just like, what is going on here? Because, you know, at school, if you were out of line at my school, you got the belt. You know, I was always getting the belt for talking, and it was horrible. It was really, really painful. You'd be left with hands numb. But there didn't seem to be any, sort of, you know, I suppose, consequences of their bad behaviour. They just sort of got into trouble a little bit. You know, even the ones that were doing really bad things, you know, the head teacher was just so sort of magnanimous. It was like, you stick to the code, if you stick to the code of the school, you'll be fine. But if you don't stick to the code, that's it, you're scrubbed. But they had this sort of quite weird code of conduct, which was quite bizarre. I mean, some of it you get, some of it you understand. You know, it's about being kind, and that resonates now. You know, it's about not being judgmental. That resonates now. But also the thing, and the interesting thing with Eileen, because her mum was the new matron, and she was a clipe, as we would say in Scotland, a telltale. You know, she was a telltale. And that was like heinous. That was like the worst thing. You know, you could do terrible things. You know, you could run out of school, you could steal, you could do all these things. But if you told on someone, that was absolutely terrible. And her mum, which I found really interesting rereading it and reading it at the time, what really struck me about her mum, who was this kind of, you know, the other matron was big and fat and lovely and cosy and comfy, like a big cottage loaf. And she was this kind of mean, you know, thin, sort of like horrible acerbic person. But that was the first time I'd really read something where adults were horrid.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And adults where I actually could see me not obeying her because she wasn't nice. And she was mean when Eileen, her daughter, would tell her that somebody was doing something naughty. She would then make holes in their stockings so that they had to darn them. I mean, that's just mean.
It's
just really, really mean-spirited. And an adult in a position of power, you know? I like the headmistress, though. She's all right. Yes. I liked her. I liked her a lot.
I think Hayley Black really liked her. And as a former teacher, I'm sure she invested in her all those fair and fine qualities that she felt people were capable of.
Absolutely. Do you think Enid Blyton identified herself with that headmistress? Because I think that. I think she was all those qualities that probably Enid Blyton would like to have.
Yes.
She put them into the headmistress.
Well, here we have our psychologist hats on, don't we? Because Enid Blyton obviously wrote very, very happily and easily as a 13-year-old girl.
Yes.
As a 13-year-old. You know, like I say, the girls in this book, and I don't know about you, but I read Mallory Towers when I was probably 11 and 12. You know,
me too.
Not at 16. But, you know, in her own life, her father, who she adored, walked out on them when she was 13. So it is that classic thing of your default becomes the last time you felt secure and you then act on it.
And that makes
sense.
So
I think
sense.
For most of it, she is all the girls. She's all the girls. Mm-hmm. But yes, with the headmistress, I think for a moment she can see it, how you could be to children.
Yeah.
Enid Blyton's own children don't particularly the younger one, don't speak well of her. And it's really interesting with the matron that she has two children. She has Eileen and Eddie. Nobody else is called things like that either, so obviously the names are important. And Eddie was supposed to be an electrician, and he's lost his job, so Eileen is stealing from her mother, the matron, to give to her brother. And when this is discovered at the end, and all the way through, the matron has said, you know, whoever is stealing from me, they will have to be expelled. Absolutely.
Yes.
And of course discovers it's her daughter. And then she says, what have I done to have the punishment on my shoulders?
Right. Now that
Which really
was
hit me quite hard.
Yeah, you know, that she's making it all about her.
Yes. Yeah.
It was weird that, wasn't it? She wasn't thinking about her kids. I mean, these poor kids. And it was interesting at the end that, you know, Eddie got a job and then Eileen didn't come back to the school, obviously, and I think she ends up getting a job as a typist or something. And the whole sort of thing about what she's writing about in the book, Enid Blyton, is more or less saying, well, that's where that class of girls should be. Now, that class of girls shouldn't really be at St Clair's because she doesn't really belong here. She's not one of us. So therefore, she goes away and does a menial job somewhere. Not that there's anything wrong being a typist, but do you know what I mean? She's not allowed to be in the gang.
I'm a bit older than you, but we are, you know, of a certain age. And I would like to say we have got to a place where it is more comfortable for women
definitely.
In the workplace.
Oh, definitely.
But it's not a done deal, is it? It's not 100%.
No.
And have you found that frustrating along the way, or does your natural tendency to just stay the course, has that stood you in good stead?
I think think I was lucky because when I joined TVAM as their correspondent, as their Scottish correspondent, I covered everything. And back then in the late, well, it was the early 80s, actually, it was 84, because it'll be 40 years I've been in Breakfast TV next year, which is scary. It just makes me think, oh no. But it was really interesting because I had to do everything. Like I say, I had to do football, I had to do sport, I had to do politics, I had all of that. So I never had that thing of, you're the girl, you just do the diddy stuff, which I know a lot of colleagues of mine had. So I sympathised with that totally. But I do think it's always a mistake to try and be in with whoever the regime happens to be. I mean, I've had so many regime changes. I just kind of do the job and get on with it. And I don't go into cliques or anything because it's pointless and it's exhausting. So I just think, go in, do your job, do it as the best of your ability. Also, though, don't pull the ladder up. You know, I mean, I think, and you're exactly the same, you have got so much experience that you've amassed over the years, all of the different things that you've done and all of your life experiences as well. You've got to pass it on. There's no, what's the point otherwise? You know, you have to pass it on, and you have to pass it on in a really positive way and help people. Otherwise, it's crazy, because that's the whole point of amassing knowledge, is to make sure that everybody benefits from that, or if they want to. I mean, you're not going to foist it upon them, but you know, it's a good thing, and I feel that now is a real privilege for me, because most of, in fact, all of my team are, gosh, far younger than I am, and they keep me young. They do, they keep me young. I'd like to think that I give them the benefit of my wisdom. I don't think I do, but they certainly give me loads back, because they keep me young, they keep me informed, they keep me excited, they keep me, you know, interested in things, and that's great. You know, it just works really well.
People often ask me what my regular London pub is, but that assumes there's a pub I can easily return to, so please stop asking that.
London Pub Reviews, written by Paul Ewan and featuring Tim Key. A hat-trick podcast.
Did you save my seat? Why? I'm at a completely different pub now, with different seats. Catch up.
Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Drinking with dignity. Yes, sir. Yes, madam. That's me all over.
All the girls boast about their parents all term, usually in a nice way, you know, that they are kind or lovely. But Angela obviously boasts big time about her parents because they have several cars and which big one they're going to turn up in, and her mother will look beautiful. And then one of the girls, Pauline, is it? Pauline, yeah.
Yes, Pauline, yes.
Says her mother is absolutely lovely. And then this, and I have to read this because it's just so awful. When the mother finally arrives at school, she is actually a plain, tired-looking woman, almost old. And all the girls are saying, oh my goodness, you know, that's not the mother that she was describing to us. And I thought, did we really think about our parents like that? Did we?
I don't think so, frankly. Everybody.
Except your mother.
Except my mum, who was a baby when she'd be. But I found the character of Pauline really tragic, because she was desperately trying to fit in. She was one of the new girls, and there's Angela with all this money that she's got, and she's beautiful, and she's this and that, and, you know, and everybody's aspiring to be her and wanting to be her friend. And then there's Pauline, who has committed the terrible sin of having straight dark hair and not being all that pretty. And she ends up, like, that's the thing, that Angela gives everybody lavish gifts and Pauline's trying to keep up with them. And, you know, there's something obviously not quite the thing about Pauline. You know that something's not quite right. We find out that she tells her mother not to come to half term because she's ashamed of her mother. And her mother obviously comes to the school when Pauline's there. Well, she breaks her leg, so her mum comes because they send for her. And people think, oh, she must be one of the maids. She must be one of the cleaners. And it's like, it's just dreadful. It's absolutely appalling. It really is that wee girl would be ashamed of her mum that's worked so hard to pay for her to be at that school.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? I love the fact, though, that it made me laugh aloud, that when she breaks her leg, which she breaks by falling off the wall bars, which I really sympathise because I hated,
well, hated the wall bars. I hated the wall bars.
Me too. And that bit where you had to climb up them and then turn round to face the room.
Oh, it's horrible.
Horrible.
No.
Obviously, Pauline had exactly the same experience because she fell off, breaks her leg, and the doctor says, she's broken her leg, clean break, nothing to worry about. That's the doctor.
Stop and nonsense, clean break, nothing to worry about. Stick to the sanatorium.
Honestly, I did laugh aloud. I thought, oh, how wonderful to be be a child reading that and think, yeah, that's all that is.
It's fine. Have you know, break your leg off?
It's no fine. Anyway, who gave what? Because all the presents they give, again, it's just wonderful, aren't they? One of them gives a magnificent blotter.
You yes, know, or that's
a purse
Holly,
with her initials
it?
On.
Yes.
I thought, did they arrive at school with all this stuff? I mean, honestly, I wouldn't have thought that at the time, so I must not get carried away
that's
here.
That's true. But where did they get those presents? You're right.
Oh, really lavish
well,
and large presents.
I thought about that.
When we come to the end of the book and Eileen's perfidy is revealed and Alison, who's the one who has pashes on somebody every single term, yes, has a pash on Angela. And then Eileen writes to her later to say, don't worry, it wasn't your fault, which is, you can almost feel that Enid Blyton needs Alison to be in the next book. You know, she's going to write
yes.
the next book. She
yes.
doesn't want to lose too many characters. She's already lost one. You know, mm-hmm. and hopefully, I don't know, I didn't read the next two books, but I hope that Angela, having learned her lesson, becomes a nicer character.
I think she does. I think she does. From memory, actually, I think she does. She does become much, much better and she becomes accepted. She adheres to the code of the school. And yeah, I think so. Now and again, she has to be taken down a peg or two, because that's the other thing that they do. Don't go above your station or you'll be taken down a peg or two.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because also, Enid Blyton herself, you know, who did have this quite a complicated life story, but was adamant that mothers should not go out to work. She prided
yes.
herself on the fact that she had a job that kept her at home, you know, because she felt that was proper mothering. However, as a little sidebar to that, of course, first of all, she cannot have been terribly present writing 50 books a year.
No, absolutely
also,
not.
Also, even if she was, she sent both her daughters to boarding school.
I know. So she didn't even do much parenting anyway. So she wasn't, you know, I mean, they were away. They were off. And that's, again, you know, like I was talking to you earlier on, I found that bizarre. I mean, I know now, you know, I know now that there's the Harry Potter thing and, you know, there's a lot of kids that actually do want to go. And there was a little bit of me that wanted to go to that school. You know, there definitely was because of the, they had a pool, a swimming pool at the school. I mean, that was just like unheard of luxury.
And they could go for a midnight swim.
Midnight swims with lashings of ginger beer and what were those paste sandwiches again, which I didn't know what paste was. I had to go and find out. But it's just
you
like,
don't have to know that, really. I think it's something that can just remain where it was in the 50s. It transpires that they're actually only up at about half 11.
I know. It never, it's not a rave, is it? Let's be honest.
It's not.
You know, paste sandwiches and ginger beer. Do not a rave make. And you imagine 16-year-olds now if you said to them, right, you're going to a party.
My 16-year-old self would have,
you know, sandwiches curled at the end and some ginger beer. They'd be like, yeah, right. That's going to happen.
Let's try it on the nearest one. What about the idea of bringing the books up to date?
I just think with those kind of books, I think you need to have the snobbishness in there so that you can tell what it was like. My thing with redoing stuff, and it happens with TV shows as well. I mean, I was just watching that about the Brinks Matt drama, a bit called Gold, and they had a woman, very senior position in there, in the special branch, you know, the flying squad at that time, and that just wouldn't have happened. She would have been making the tea and getting her bum felt, sadly. That's the reality of it. And I think sometimes when you change things, if you don't have the context at our age that we would know that that's actually not strictly true, that's what we were striving for. But I think it sort of in a way demeans the fight. That women have had in particular, and the fight that we've had, you know, to stop this kind of snobbery and to stop this kind of, I mean, blatant racism that we saw in Enid Blyton books, which even as a kid, I knew there was something not right about it. But it takes you now to look back. So if you change it, it's like that never happened. And I don't think that's a particularly good idea. I think it's like the whole Roald Dahl thing. It was too late for me and too early for my daughter in a way, although obviously I'm very, very aware of all of his work. But if you take away all of the questionable content, I don't think it's a good thing, because I think you have to realise how far we've come and how far we've still to go. And I think you do need to have these very difficult conversations. And you can have these conversations with your kids as well. It's quite a good thing. You know,
it is.
I think we want to see that we've made progress, you know, that we have made progress, and I think that's important. I wouldn't imagine that many young people, if any, are reading Enid Blyton now. I'd be astounded if they were. You know, I think it is more like, for me, it's nostalgia, you know, looking back to that. I'm looking back on it with clearer eyes, obviously, and quite, not so much shocked by the Claudine at St. Clair's. I mean, there's some things in there that are really dodgy, but it's not as bad as a hell of a lot of the other things that she wrote. But you can look back on it like that. But I don't think kids are reading that now. I don't think so. I'd like to think no, because I think we've moved on. We've just moved on. But as you say, a great storyteller. I think you just leave it in the past where it absolutely belongs. And now and again, if you did want to dip into that, and hopefully you would look at it and be shocked, and at the same time, exactly my reaction and your reaction, barely laugh at the ludicrousness of it and how silly it was and how snobbish. I mean, the snobbery is just, you know, it is astonishing. But the thing that really did kind of at the end, I suppose, make a little bit of sense and she redeemed herself a bit, was that the code does include the fact that FD's the same.
Yes.
But yeah. I think with her, some are more the same than others. It's the kind of, you know, it's the kind of Animal Farm thing, isn't it? All little girls at school are equal, but some are more equal than others. And if your name's Eileen, you're stuffed. It's like, I think that is a typist.
The perfect summary. Did your daughter read them?
No, not really. No, she was kind of just about. She was like me. She reads all the time. She's like me. She was kind of Harry Potter-ish. Was just coming to the whole kind of Harry Potter thing, and then she started reading what I would call sort of teen books, you know, a lot of teen books, and then a lot of my stuff as well. So she read like baby books when she was wee, obviously. That was the first present I ever got her, I always remember it, it was a wee book with a duck on it, but it was like you could read it in the bath. It was, you know, those ones. Do you remember them? And then do you remember the ones, the rag books she used to get, and they were kind of like scalloped at the edges, and there were wee rag books that used to, I loved all that. It was great, absolutely brilliant. But no, I do think Enid is in the past, but it was a joy to read that again in many ways for so many reasons. It brought back so many memories, good ones, as well as sort of like, goodness me, very, very, very strange. And like I say, reading is amazing, and I was so lucky to have a library. Just so lucky to have a library. I don't know what I would have done without it. I really don't. Because, you know, it was just like walking in. I love the smell of the library, and walking in and all these fantastic books. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to have time to read these all of these books. And that was just in one library in one wee place. Ah, it's amazing.
I mean, although you didn't go to university, I'm deeply envious of the fact that you've got sort of rectorships of universities.
Oh, do you know, that was the bestest thing. I was rector of Dundee University, and there's a brilliant tradition when you become rector, and it was started by the Queen Mother, that the rugby team drag you in a sort of little prammy coach thing, you know, ramshackle-y thing, but they drag you around the city and you have to have a drink in every bar. Hurrah!
So the Queen Mother started that?
Queen Mother started that. So I was the second female rector, and I was dragged around the streets of Dundee by the female rugby club, and we had a blast. It was fantastic. I loved it because I felt as if I got university life without doing any work. And then they gave me an honorary degree.
You certainly got Freshers' Week. As I understand, I didn't go to university either, but as I understand it, that's pretty much Freshers' Week.
It was, shall we just say, it was a blur. It was a wee blur. We'll leave it to that.
I am very jealous of that. And also that you, what's your connection with Black Watch?
Yeah, I was the honorary colonel of the Black Watch cadets. That was amazing. Do you know that big, burly, hairy men had to salute me, which is ridiculous. But as I said to them, I said, oh, please don't. You know, I would sort of give them a cuddle. Please don't salute me. This is, I'm very embarrassed. And they go, no, we're not saluting you. We're saluting the badge that you're representing. So then that made me feel a little bit better. But that was great fun. But you know, the maddest thing about that was I was asked to, not set off. Set off, I guess. The 1 o'clock gun in Edinburgh. And the man said, look, I'm going to say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire. And then you're going to do this at 1 o'clock and it's all going to be fantastic. And I was like, yeah, fine, no problem at all. He said five, and I thought he said fire, so I pressed the button. And it's the first time in the history of the 1 o'clock gun in Edinburgh, because, you know, it goes off at 1 o'clock, right? But it went off slightly earlier that day, all down to me. And they were just like, just looking at me and shaking their heads. I just say, never get a civilian to do a job like that. Give it to the army to do it.
I'm very struck by the fact that you obviously you didn't go to university, me too, and that you have retained that love of learning. To go back to the book, the girls don't do an awful lot of that, do they? That doesn't sing out from the pages.
Gosh, you're absolutely right. Nobody does any studying. They're too busy letting off stink bombs and having midnight snacks and arguing with one another and sneaking out to see the brothers and stealing. Nobody does any work. Nobody does any work at St. Clair's. It's outrageous. What are those women going to do? What are those young girls going to do when they leave school? I suppose they have to, as Enid Blyton would say, they have to get married and stay at home and have babies, because that's all you do if you're a girl.
Yes. But with their code of honour intact.
Code of honour intact. I wasn't sure whether to do that one or whether to do a Just William, but I'm glad we did that, because there's a lot in there, wasn't there? There's a lot
I'm
to
really
unpack.
Glad we did it, because I haven't read Enid Blyton since I was a child.
Nor
and I hadn't read, I was in Mallory Towers, but I would not be able to quote you any of it. You know, I think that's the brilliant thing about her writing, actually, is that her writing doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
And for an author, that in a way, that's what you want. You know, you want people to go, I loved your book, but they don't want to pick up the fine tune of how you got there. Yeah, exactly. I just loved your book. You know, I love those characters. And yeah, it's a place of safety, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
The whole
of
it is a place of safety. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Janet. It was great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Joyful. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Twice Upon a Time with me, Janet Ellis. The producer is Caroline Raphael. Recording and post-production by John Wakefield and Diggory Waite. All the titles mentioned are on the podcast show page. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Twice Upon a Pod for pictures of our guests and their brilliant books. And if you like the show, do recommend to a friend or leave us a review. The executive producer is Claire Broughton. And Twice Upon a Time is a Hat Trick podcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.